Our delicious topic this afternoon is urban foraging. Now, I will admit to being a keen amateur at this, and if you've never foraged before, it could seem a rather daunting prospect. You can get wet, you can get dirty. Occasionally, as I've found, you can get well stung by a rogue wasp. And all of this for a handful of berries, some windfall apples, some unusual greens. And yet, the popularity of foraging is increasing. The search for wild food, I think, mirrors the surge in popularity for homegrown produce, allotments, and even guerrilla gardening, where patches of vacant and underused inner city land are converted into these al fresco fruit and vegetable patches. And philosophically, it's very much linked to a concern about the wider food chain, about our place in it, about the coming oil and energy and water crises, about the way that climate change can and will change the way we look and use land. So, is it just a slightly quirky hobby, or, as my teenage son says, is it the most embarrassing thing you've ever done, Mum? Or is it essential to our thinking about localized food economies? With me are three men who may be able to answer that question. In the studio is Darren Flint, local food activist, who runs independent foraging walks in South London. Paul Mackay from Transition Belsize in North London also runs foraging days for individuals, but uses these urban fruits in a very community-centred way as well as an individual way. And joining us on the phone, Andy Overall, who is an expert in mushrooms. He's a co-founder of Fungi to Be With and conducts regular forays onto Hampstead Heath to explore, to pick, to learn about the mushrooms growing quietly all around us in the city. So welcome, all three of you. I'll come to you first, Darren, if I might. Why? Why forage? Why do you do it?
Well, it's like a lot of people, I grew up on the edge of the countryside, picking brambles, that's blackberries, picking wild apples, and always being having that kind of on the edge of my childhood habits, something that you just do in season as a little fun pastime. Mm-hmm. And it's something I never much thought about for quite a few years until, to be honest, when I moved to London, I felt quite disconnected from nature, from that sense of being on the edge of the countryside and having natural things around me that I could eat and feel connected to the landscape I'm living in. So I quite deliberately started practicing wild food foraging without really knowing that that's what I was doing. I was going out and making a point of picking and using as many wild brambles as I could the first autumn that I lived in London, going out and finding where I could find apple trees that I could pick. And from those very common, very obvious things that you can buy in the supermarket, I think I increased my knowledge. I chose to educate myself to kind of push the envelope more and more, and discovered that a large proportion of the stuff that you see growing around you is actually useful from a food point of view, and started picking things that are kind of less common.
And of course, Paul, the foods that you pick in a wild search for food are very different from the ones you get in the supermarket. Is there sort of a different headspace that you have to be in to see them and to use them, do you think?
I think, yes. I mean, obviously, going out and foraging for sort of foods, you know, we've used them to sort of try various types of food production and things. And I guess there's an element of, you know, it certainly isn't going to look the same as it will in the supermarket. So there's a need to kind of be aware of that and sort of adjust your perspective on you know what you're looking for and you know what you're prepared to kind of use while foraging for things, but also there's that element of the sort of fun of it of looking and picking out the right ingredients and trying to come up with things, and it is you know just kind of sort of hunting for things when you are foraging and you have to search and find things is part of the sort of excitement of doing it, I think.
Yeah, because, you know, you go into the supermarket and you pick something up because you want to cook something with that ingredient. Foraging, it seems to me, is entirely the opposite. You go out and whatever you find, you then have to be rather creative about using. Would that be your experience?
Mm. Actually, that's something that I really love about foraging, is exactly this sense of not knowing what you're going to find and then trying to be creative with something maybe that you've never cooked before. I still keep finding things for the first time growing in the wild that I've not found before. and suddenly learning how to cook with that ingredient is great fun.
And I mean, as I say, I'm a keen amateur, and I could probably spot a crab apple at, you know, 50 paces. But what I'm not so confident with, Andy, is mushrooms. And I think a lot of people are a bit sort of afraid of that whole aspect of ending up picking up the one that's going to make them sick or what have you. And so it's something you may see me on one of your courses eventually. Can you tell me a little bit about what you do?
The whole point behind Fungi to Be With was to bring it to the general public, because it was a subject that was quite stuffy, really. Mushrooms and toadstools, fungi. It's kind of kept behind closed doors and quite precious. And so when I got into it, I felt that it was something that could be shared. And I'm sure I felt that there were lots of people that felt this, that were out there thinking, oh, look at those, look at these, can we eat them? Know that. So that's why Fungi to Be With began. And so now, many years down the line, I think a lot of people can decipher certain fungi from others. But it takes some time, and you have to get to know these things, you know. You have to get familiar with them, you know. It's not that difficult, but you need to spend a little time doing it. And a lot of people think by coming on one walk or on one workshop or whatever that they're going to know all the answers. It's not that simple, you know. You have to spend a little time to get to know them.
How long would you say someone would have to spend sort of going on the forays like the ones you do on?
I think if you spend a season or two, you know, popping out yourself, come on a walk, come on a couple of walks, you know, come for a couple of years and come on a couple of walks. But you need to go out yourself. You need to spend a little time doing it yourself. So you get a couple of good books, you go out and you pick stuff, not generally just for eating to start with, and just get familiar with the different types that are out there. And that way you start to recognise the different characteristics that certain specimens or species have, like the death cap, and you know, which is one of the most deadly ones, and then the sep, which is like one of the top edibles. You get to see the differences between them. You need to get familiar with them.
Yeah, I agree. I wouldn't personally feel confident yet. I've heard that in France, actually, if you pick a mushroom, you could go into a pharmacy and the pharmacists are all trained to identify that. Is that true?
Yeah, there are places like that where you can go abroad. Yeah, and that of course is crucial. If you picked a death cap and you went in and showed him that, he would know it straight away. So 9 times out of 10, anyway. You'd walk away and throw it back. So, yeah, here you've got nothing like that.
No.
I mean, I offer, when people come on the walks and the workshops, I say, look, always take a digital camera with you. And if you find stuff that you're unsure of, etc., take some good pictures up of the top and the bottom and send them over, and I'll give you an answer.
Fantastic.
So that's one way of doing it.
Well, I wanted to ask, actually, and I'll throw this open to Paul, is it ethical to forage? I mean, there's food all around us here. A lot of it is in public spaces. If all 14 million of us within the M25 started foraging, we'd probably strip London bare within a day or two. So are there ethical issues involved with foraging?
Well, certainly. I mean, obviously, we're sort of, if we're going out there foraging for food and things, we're doing that as a part of nature, and of course there's lots of other wildlife and things that also have their own rights to some of that food. I mean, I think, so certainly, you know, that's how we approach sort of foraging, say, that, you know, we go and do on Hampstead Heath, is that, you know, there's sort of a foraging code, you know, approach it, you know, if you see some, you know, some plants that you want to take, you know, be mindful of, you know, how much you're foraging and sort of how, you know, how much you're taking away, and make sure there's enough to sort of, you know, for the plant to sort of keep reseeding itself or, you know, whatever makes sense. I mean, I suppose sort of flipping on its head, you know, you say sort of everyone in the M25 was doing this, you know, I mean, I think, you know, the position we're sort of coming from in transition is that at the moment a lot of people don't have the understanding of what can be foraged. They don't harvest the fruits that are there, and there's huge amounts of wasted, you know, wasted sort of produce and things, say in the case of fruit trees and things, that, that absolutely could be harvested. And sort of the goal within transition is to kind of raise that awareness amongst people and try to encourage people to be harvesting that fruit so it's not going to waste, and obviously reduces food miles, and there's an ethical angle from the perspective of reducing our impact sort of on the planet. And this is sort of one, you know, one small way that, that can contribute towards that. So,
I'm astounded actually at how much there is around London. I mean, I tend to look up obviously for trees. I'm going to start learning to look down for greens and mushrooms and what have you. But where have all these trees come from? Where has all this fruit come from?
Mm. Well, there's, I suppose, waves of useful trees in London from the native natural trees that have just been there since before areas of the city were developed, ancient trees that are still providing useful things, through to Victorian planting when there were many fashions, fads and phases for different types of tree, sometimes ornamental, sometimes useful, food producers, nut producers. Through to the early 20th century, where there was a lot of planting of useful things going on. There were a lot of hedgerows, for instance, would be made of rose hips, this type of thing. In recent years, I suppose from the 60s and 70s, there's been maybe the attitude that it can be more trouble than it's worth for councils to look after fruiting trees. But again, I think there's a slight turn happening there, and councils are coming back around to planting again, and of course people's gardens and wild trees that have just carried on, not just the ancient ones, but that are still kind of thriving today in the natural ecosystem that is part of London.
And is it legal? I mean, is it legal to pick all these things, whether it's fruit or mushrooms or nuts or greens? I mean,
I think you'll find there are bylaws in place in certain areas that some enforce more strictly than others. You know, that certainly is the case with fungi, with mushrooms. Certain areas around the outskirts of London and also within the central London area, you might get a slap on the wrist or your mushrooms taken away from you if you get caught by the wrong person in the wrong place.
And what about things like when you're walking around and somebody's tree is overhanging the fence onto the sidewalk? Is it legal? Can you pick that?
Well, I mean, part of so in Transition Belsize, we have two distinct groups. We have one that's looking at foraging and people are learning about foraging and the plants and identification. But then we have a separate fruit tree mapping and harvesting group, which is the one that I'm organising. And so what's specific about that then is that what we do is if we see trees that people have, you know, we'll walk around the neighbourhood, we'll maybe see them in their front gardens. If we're lucky, we might see them in the back gardens. But then we go and sort of ring on the door and say, you know, how do you feel about us helping to harvest some of this fruit? Because otherwise we're seeing that, you know, maybe it's just going to waste. And then we'll say, well, if we can harvest the tree, we'll give you, say, 25% of the fruit, or, you know, whatever sort of they feel they want. And then they get the tree harvested, they get less rotting fruit on the ground, they get some fruit for themselves, and we take away the rest.
Come and do my apple tree in my garden if you want.
Sure.
You'd think people would be grateful. Really, I mean, I find the waste terrible when I go around and I see either berries sort of, you know, wasting on the branch or apples falling and rotting on the ground. I think, what a terrible, terrible waste. And I'm also so amazed at the abundance of what there is in a city area, because we think of finding food as a sort of rural pursuit, but it really isn't, is it?
I found when I moved to London that the things that I was starting to be able to find that I recognised, again, just as classic foods, things like rocket and things, walnuts, almonds, were things I'd never dream of actually finding up in Yorkshire where I come from in the wild. It would be once in a blue moon you'd find something as useful as that. But in London, it's such a productive, rich ecosystem because of all the history of people kind of adding on to what nature would provide itself. Mm.
I think it's fair to say that we are all of a sort of strange mindset, and here's where I get to introduce my geek study. There was actually a study done on the mindset of foragers a while back, and the authors were sort of saying that, you know, whether you're searching out ripe berries or new star systems, there is a particular type, a mental type, that is really good at foraging, and that foraging in our ancestry was really an essential component of developing human awareness and curiosity and the creativity to work through a problem and think fluidly through it. And actually, through their sort of virtual experiences, experiments rather, what they found is that the same sort of human awareness that makes you a really aggressive Scrabble player, you know, makes you also a really good forager, because you will look and you will pay attention and you'll have that kind of consciousness that says, this is ripe, this is the wrong color, this is the right season, this is the right day. And I think if you sort of cogitate on that for a while, because you hear all the time about how kids these days just don't have the attention spans, maybe that's because we're not foraging anymore. I don't know. What do you think?
I think we've lost that instinct. Yeah, a lot of people have lost that instinct. I mean, like the other guy. I mean, the other guys there. I grew up in the country, so I had an affinity with it. I felt a part of it, and I did different things then. When I was younger, I was like, I used to collect birds eggs. That's what people did when they were younger in those days. And my dad did it, you know. But the thing is I got really tuned in. To what was around me and where I might find this or might find that. And I never lost that. As I grew up, I got into other things, music, etc. But I never lost that sort of sharpness. And that I've brought into the mushroom thing. So you get an awareness. You walk into an area and you think, this is going to be here. This might be there. Mm. You know, and obviously the trees play a big part of that. But I think that's kind of disappearing. Our kids don't seem to be into that so much anymore. Those country pursuits, you know, etc., etc. And obviously in the city, it's even harder to get people into that. Hence the reason why Fungi to Be With is so successful. I think people are trying to touch base.
Paul, you thought you had a response. You had a sharp intake of breath there.
Well, I was just going to say, I mean. You know, when you talk about kids and this kind of thing, I mean, my experience is, I mean, there's just tremendous interest for kind of doing the foraging and also the fruit harvesting stuff.
Sure.
I mean, we had our Belsize Green Fair on Saturday, and we had about 50 people signing up for walks, you know, that we did two foraging walks out onto the heath, and huge amounts of interest. Lots of people coming along. We're very disappointed if they just missed the start of the walk, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And as well with kids, you know, I've been doing some fruit harvesting sessions now around Belsize. And you know, sort of parents walking their children around the neighbourhood. You know, we had cases where we're sort of picking, say, fruit off a large tree or something, and they'll just come by and they go, "Wow, what are you doing? Oh, you know, can we join in? Can we try this?" You know, and the kids will take the fruit pickers and they'll have a go, and it's, you know, and they really get into it and they don't want to leave. And then we had one kid, he filled up the back of his little sort of tractor trailer thing, you know,
right.
And he, you know, cycled off into the distance with a big basket of pears in the back, you know. And and so, you know, they just really enjoy it, I think, you know. But it's about sort of finding opportunities for kids to try this stuff.
Yeah, sure.
This as opposed to my teenage son who cowered in the back of the car when I got out one day to pick some crab apples. So yes, I think that's really encouraging, actually. And yeah. The one thing that I've learned as I've sort of dipped my toe into this, that, you know, if you're foraging, you kind of look at things and you ask questions like, is it safe? Is it ripe? Is it edible? Will it nurture me or will it poison me? And what if you asked that same question of the foods in the supermarket, you know, when you were going up and down the aisles, you know, if you picked up your highly processed potato snack and said, is this poisonous or is this nurturing? You know, it actually starts you asking questions that you might never ask before. Mm. Anybody?
Yeah. I've found a curious thing on my walks is that people will collect mushrooms that are past it and not even question the fact that they're past it, whereas if you went into a supermarket to buy mushrooms and they looked past it, they wouldn't touch them. I've found that a bit odd.
I'd be a bit dubious about that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I have to throw that. I check all their stuff, but I found that quite. They just think because it's wild, and it's slightly it looks slightly old. It doesn't matter, but in a supermarket, it does.
Yeah, people can be quite surprised as well. I mean, we had tons of sort of pears and apples and things on the stalls that we had at this fair on Saturday, and we were just giving them away to anybody who wanted to try them. And most people would sort of taste these pears, and it was, you know, and they'd say, "Oh, where are these from?" So, well, just a couple of hundred yards down the road from a big tree we harvested, you know, and they'd be really surprised at how nice they were, and they're really sweet and all this kind of thing. So, you know, that's sort of, I think, again, a bit of an eye-opener for people.
So, I mean, we do it individually for fun, you know, and it is fun, and it does change you, I think, philosophically, spiritually, however you want to put it. But how does this fit in with notions of energy descent and a more localized food economy? Because obviously we can't all feed ourselves just from foraging. So where does it fit in into the big puzzle of that?
I guess for me, every portion of salad that you forage, every portion of fruit that you foraged yourself, has virtually no embodied energy in it in terms of oil input, in terms of food miles, and it's one less portion that you're placing a demand on the global food system for. So for everything that you can forage, you're just making that little bit of a difference in terms of all these things. You're helping to diversify the food base locally. So if you're doing it, if people in the community are doing it, and if you can act together as well, doing things like these schemes to community harvest fruits and things, then every time you do that, you're just making that little bit of a difference in a very practical way, and that all adds up.
Is that what you find, Paul?
Well, absolutely. I mean, these are sort of, you know, with transition. I mean, transition itself, say, as a movement, is still very young, you know, in many ways. And but I mean, these are sort of small steps that we're sort of taking towards, you know, what could be a much bigger vision, perhaps in future, which is the kind of thing we're thinking about for sort of say 20 years hence. Is, you know, how do we increase that resilience? You know, it's about being more self-resilient, self-reliant within a community, not entirely self-sufficient, because we're never going to achieve that. But having a bit more kind of resilience to whatever, you know, things may affect us. But, you know, if you start to look at things like sort of permaculture forest gardens and things, where you really intensively, and people say if they have a back garden, they really intensively plant fruit trees and lots of other perennial edible plants and things like that, you can actually be tremendously productive and combine that with annuals and things. And so, you know, starting to have people thinking about these things, being aware of what are the perennial plants that they can forage wild, but then they could also have those in the back garden, you know, and so on and so forth. So it's all sort of building that awareness, building that consciousness, and then starting to build the skills and just open people's minds to these kind of possibilities, you know.
Is it a form of activism, do you think? It sounds like such a gentle pursuit, but is it also a form of protest?
It can be. I think it depends. It depends if you're just casually walking down the road and you see something tasty and you just pick it and eat it and think nothing more of it. Or if you're going out there kind of really intensely thinking, yes, I'm reducing my carbon footprint, I'm going to eat everything today or this week without putting any demands on any supermarkets or any supply chains. Yeah, it can be a political stance, but again, it can be that very genteel, timeless pastime.
I think also sort of listening to all of you talking about, you know, that there are rules. There are rules for looking at mushrooms. There are rules for picking fruit, et cetera, et cetera. It's also an acceptance that there are some rules around our food supply that we have ignored for a very, very long time. At the moment, modern food doesn't recognize season, it doesn't recognize geography, it doesn't recognize any boundary at all. And one of the interesting things about local and seasonal is that it says, no, there are boundaries. And if you pick what you need, rather than the excess that our food system supplies on, you also get rid of waste as well. Mm. And I think that's very important. You were talking, Andy, about, you know, mushrooms past their prime in the supermarket. All that stuff just gets thrown out. Supermarkets love excess.
Sure. And they get thrown into areas where the spores germinate, and then you get them growing wild. That often happens.
Is that a bad thing?
No, that's great. It's great. Because then you've got your shop markets growing just on a little rubbish heap somewhere, you know. They're that good at doing it. But yeah, one thing that does spoil it slightly certainly on the mushroom front is commercial collection, you know, commercial collectors, and that's where it kind of spoils it for a small thing, you know, the thing, the sort of individual, because you go into the forest and you just find stuff heaped up in places, and you get red-faced wardens and so forth, because people have come in and done a sweep. So on that front, it can be not a nice experience, but it's sport for everybody else, because someone else is being greedy.
Well, I wanted to ask that, because as with all I don't want to call it a food fashion, but I can't think of another word at the moment. But as with all ways that where we look at different ways of feeding ourselves, eventually there is going to be a commercial component to this. And I know Scotland is sort of leading the UK in terms of its sort of number of foragers. And there are commercial companies now that are picking wild foods and taking them to top-end restaurants and selling them to supermarkets. And I just wonder if now is the time to either nip that in the bud or make some rules about it or what have you, because this is, it shouldn't be niche food. It should be good food for all.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, well, certainly with fungi, with mushrooms, it's been going on for some time, the actual commercial aspect of it. And it started in places like the New Forest, where you'd get actually people coming from abroad to collect and then take it back, because they've got restrictions in their own countries. But you know, the good thing about this, about England, is it hasn't come down heavy and sort of brought in licensing restrictions. But, I mean, they've tried it in some areas, but they find that people ignore it, but they've not sort of made it an absolute. But some areas where you go, Epping Forest One, if you go there and you're seen collecting mushrooms by a warden, he will take them off you.
Wow.
They are very strict about it. But other areas where you go, they're a bit looser about it. It just depends, like I said earlier, this is a direct byproduct of commercial collecting.
This is
the problem.
Yeah, it kind of spoils it for everybody, doesn't it? And I suspect, I don't know, Paul, if you agree, that really when it comes to this sort of wild food, that the community ought to come first. Because I know you give out to schools and things like that, don't you, some of your harvest?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly something we're sort of looking into. I mean, this has been our sort of first year, really, of doing some significant harvesting activities sort of around Belsize area. I know, say, in Kensal and Kilburn, they harvested about 2 tonnes of fruit last year, and we're distributing that all over. So, yeah, I mean, that's kind of the goal of what we're doing. And certainly that will be much preferable is keep it in the community and give it to those people who sort of need it the most and that kind of thing. So
do you think there'd be some pushback from the local councils about that? I mean, do you think if they were faced with some commercial concern, you know, selling to Harrods or someone wanting to give it to school children, what do you think? Do you think they would jump to the commercial concern?
Well, I mean, I have a contact in Camden Council who sort of works with schemes like this sort of around Camden, and she's very enthusiastic about what we're doing, and she provide a list of sort of organisations and schools and that kind of thing who are quite willing to sort of take donations of fruit and that kind of thing. So I think that they're certainly very keen. They're very encouraging of sort of what we're trying to do.
Darren?
Yeah, I suppose it's part of the general movement towards a greater awareness in local government about sustainability issues and about the need to mitigate the effects of climate change, of peak oil and of all these other pressures, of food prices, the list goes on. Mm. And I think the awareness is there in local government, and particularly in London. There are some very good initiatives kind of already agreed, not even on the table. It's just a slow, gradual process, as with any part of bureaucracy, I suppose, of it actually being put into place. So I suppose the job falls to those of us kind of out in the community that are interested in this agenda, because this is the political side of it. It is a political agenda. Mm. It falls to us to kind of push the issue and to make sure that councils are actually implementing what they themselves know they should be doing.
Yeah.
And there are very sound economic cases, there are very sound social benefit cases to be made there that support things like wild food foraging and local food networks.
I would imagine, particularly in less advantaged areas, you know, we have this sort of Enid Blyton view of foraging, but in areas where there really is some poverty, giving people those skills and showing them that they can at least be somewhat self-sufficient would be really, really useful. Mm. Anyway, that is, we're going to end on that very positive note. Who's here next week? I have no idea. I'm going to go and forage some guests, and we hope that you will join us next week at the same time. Thank you very much. Bye.